Chapter 13. Who is Joseph DeAngelo?
He was a nameless, faceless person. He wasn't anyone that I could point the finger at and say, that's the guy that did this to me. He was just maybe out there, maybe he wasn't, maybe he was dead, and maybe we'll never know who he is. Now there's a person, now there's a man named Joseph DeAngelo that did this to me, that did this to a 13-year-old.
After it was revealed that Joseph James DeAngelo's DNA matched that of the Golden State Killer, the world ravenously followed the news and rushed to the internet to find out any information they could.
I'll just say it. I would be one of the people that was at home constantly hitting refresh on Google, wanting to know, oh my gosh, who was it? Where did he live? You know, what is the backstory?
I get on Facebook and I start looking for this Joseph DeAngelo.
I immediately wanted to see what this guy looked like. I wanted to know if this was somebody that I knew, if my mom knew him, if we were friends with him or acquaintances, or was he in Janelle's phone book? Who was this guy? I saw his face and I just did not recognize him. His pictures when he was younger don't look like anybody that we knew or hung out with. And I've asked my friends, do any of you know this guy or did you know him in the past? And nobody knew him.
Here's what we know about Joseph DeAngelo at the time of this recording. He was born in 1945 in Bath, New York. He attended middle school in Rancho Cordova, the very area where many of his East Area Rapist attacks occurred. He then went on to graduate in June 1964 from Folsom High School in a nearby suburb of Sacramento.
After high school, he joined the Navy. He was in the Navy for 4 years.
According to local reports at the time, Joseph DeAngelo saw 22 months of combat in the Vietnam War.
And then he ends up going to school, studying criminal justice, was an intern at Roseville PD. He was engaged at one point to this Bonnie, and they never got married. And then in 1973, he marries his wife. So he is married at the time of the Visalia Ransacker series. And at the time of Visalia Ransacker, he is a full-time police officer for Exeter PD and ultimately promoted up to a sergeant at Exeter.
Exeter is a small town in the San Joaquin Valley about 200 miles south of Sacramento. In 1973, a brief article in the Exeter Sun newspaper announces Joseph DeAngelo as a new officer on the Exeter Police Force. Ironically, it says, James DeAngelo Jr. believes that without law and order, there can be no government, and without a democratic government, there can be no freedom. Law enforcement is his career, he says, and his job is serving the community.
My name's Nick Willick. Joseph DeAngelo came to work for the Auburn Police Department in 1976.
1976 is also the year the East Area Rapist attacks begin. The small city of Auburn is only 30 miles away from the east side of Sacramento.
He had worked 3 years down at Exeter Police Department. I don't really know much about his background at that point. At that time, I was a patrol sergeant. I did have the opportunity to work a few times with Joe DeAngelo on the street. Joe DeAngelo was, he didn't really fit what you would call the typical mold of a police officer. He didn't have the personality traits that most officers have. He was probably, if you would rate him, probably below average officer. He lacked in what I believe to be officer safety techniques. And I know that on several occasions I called him out on those. And he wasn't very susceptible to criticism. Matter of fact, he would kind of pout after you told him that, hey, you should do this way. He had oddities. He really did. He had a nickname of Junk Food Joey. And he was all the time this can of soda pop or a bag of potato chips in his hands, you know, something. He was eating all the time, licorice. Like I said, he was, I thought, didn't exhibit good officer safety practices. One time I was, as a sergeant, I responded to a silent alarm and I was crossing in front of the building, and he came up to the front of the building and illuminated me with the alley lights in front of the glass. And it was a false alarm. It wasn't a major thing, but it was definitely a mistake. I gave him a verbal reprimand for that. And like I said, then he'd kind of pout after that. He also had a tendency to violate people's space. He would, officers as well as citizens. As a lieutenant one time, received a complaint about him, and the citizen who called and complained wasn't able to give any specifics other than he thought the person was rude. And I asked him, I said, well, did he use profanity? No. Did he contradict you or interrupt you? Well, not really, but he was just rude. And so he wasn't able to say why, but there was something that bothered him about the contact. I was out on the street one time, shortly thereafter that, he got dispatched to a complaint at a service station. And I pulled off alongside the road and watched him. And he was, you know, real close to the person, and he kept touching the person and talking to him. You know, he was just talking to him, but kind of like patting him on the shoulder. And we have a space. For an officer, that space is very important, because when you get that close, the person has access to your weapons for officer safety, as well as just a common respect of the person you're talking to. I said that, look, you know, I said, don't touch people. Keep your distance, you know. And he says, well, I was telling him I was sorry. I said, no. Maintain professional attitude all the time. You don't need to pat him on the shoulder. And no, he would pout. It was almost juvenile, I guess.
While Joseph DeAngelo is working as an officer at the Auburn Police Department, the East Area Rapist is routinely breaking into homes and raping women a short distance away in Sacramento, as many as 4 a month.
Property crimes is one of the major crimes that we have in this area, so it would have been routine for him to respond.
As burglary victims in Auburn call the cops to respond to these crimes, it's possible that it's the East Area Rapist who shows up at their doorstep in a police uniform. But then, in July 1979, the East Area Rapist attacks come to an end. This occurs at the same time that Joseph DeAngelo is fired from the Auburn Police Department for shoplifting.
He was arrested for shoplifting a hammer as well as a can of dog repellent. He was arrested by the Sacramento Sheriff's Department. Upon hearing that, we suspended him and started our investigation. That investigation lasted about a month. He was terminated in August. He filed an appeal, and he pled not guilty to the theft. He went to court on the charge. Matter of fact, he had a jury trial, testified, and he was found guilty. And so he was, at that point, officially gone from the Auburn Police Department. I have no idea why would a police officer be shoplifting. After the incident occurred, several officers had said that he had all sorts of tools in his garage, officers that had been over to his house. And I think one officer said, well, he had 2 or 3 drills still in the box. So it kind of appeared to us that maybe he had been shoplifting for a while.
What's the significance of the shoplifting? Was it to avoid looking suspicious, buying things that he would later use to commit crimes? Was it forensic sophistication because he knew that they'd be able to track these items back to him? Or was it because he's a psychopath who craves excitement?
Somewhere in that period, I received a call from the city's worker comp adjuster, and he told me that Joe had filed a workers' comp claim. He said the stress of the job had caused him to commit the theft. And he was blaming the stress of the job on me. And because I fired him and I didn't like him, you know. The adjuster also told me that DeAngelo said he came to my house to kill me, but couldn't find my bedroom. And even then, to be honest with you, I just didn't believe it. Joe DeAngelo just did not strike me as that type of person that could do something like that. But still, no, you police officers do get threatened. And as a police officer, my number one responsibility is my family. And so we talked about it as a family, what to do if someone strange comes to the house.
We know that in 1979, a prowler woke up Nick Willick's 4-year-old daughter in the middle of the night by shining a flashlight into her window. But what we don't know is, why didn't he break in?
Even today, that is a big question in my mind. Why didn't he enter my house? There was nothing exceptional about the house. There were no sophisticated locks or anything on it. Even afterwards, why would he admit to that? I mean, he must have been smart enough to know that when you make that type of claim, that's going to be reported. I don't know. I don't have that answer.
A question that Nick Willick thinks he can answer is whether or not an Auburn police officer could commit these attacks while on duty.
No, the answer to that is definitely no. Oftentimes, there would only be two officers on the street. When you went to a call, your other officers responded and backed you up. And it would have been difficult for him, impossible for that to happen. A sergeant would not have allowed him. And if he was missing, he would have known that. His days off and during his vacations, it's not that far away. It's a 30, 35-minute drive. He could have committed the crimes, absolutely. I've seen on social media, should have known. I don't know how I should have known. Trust me, I beat myself up better than anybody does. I'm very difficult, hard on myself. And Joe DeAngelo was he was an embarrassment to all the tens of thousands of good men and women who put their lives on the line every day. And you have someone like Joe DeAngelo that really harms that image because it's a rarity. Joe DeAngelo was not a police officer. He was a person masquerading as a police officer.
The Golden State Killer commits his next attack in October 1979, over 400 miles south of Sacramento. And this is where we lose track of Joseph DeAngelo's whereabouts. He moves out of Auburn, but exactly where he goes is still a mystery. At the time of this recording, few details of his timeline are known. We do know that back in 1973, the Sacramento Bee announced that then 27-year-old Joseph DeAngelo married 20-year-old Sharon Huddle. It's also been reported that in the late 1970s, Joseph DeAngelo asked his brother-in-law, James, "What do you think of that East Area rapist? What would you do, Jim?" To which James Huddle replied, "If he got his hands on him, he'd attack him." We know the first of Joseph DeAngelo and Sharon Huddle's three daughters was born in 1981, 6 weeks after Sherry Domingo and Gregory Sanchez were murdered. We also know that in 1983, the family moved into the same Citrus Heights home where 35 years later, Joseph DeAngelo was arrested. Shortly after Janelle Cruz was murdered in 1986, DeAngelo's second daughter was born. Sharon Huddle gave birth to their third daughter in 1989. The same year that Joseph DeAngelo began working as a trailer mechanic at Save Mart. In April 2018, when Joseph DeAngelo was arrested at home and later accused of 50 rapes and 13 murders, the story was broadcast and celebrated worldwide. But in Sacramento, his closest friends were shocked and struggled to comprehend that the man they knew as a neighbor, co-worker, and friend had been arrested for the monstrous crimes of the Golden State Killer.
My name is Richard Mangang, and I was Joe DeAngelo's closest friend. To me, he was Joe instead of Joseph. I first met Joe in 2007. He was a trailer mechanic, and I was a driver. It's funny, the way we met, I heard two guys, or actually three guys, chiming in on about fishing. And I, being a fisherman, I love fishing. I just happened to jump into conversation, and our friendship began there. He took me on his boat a couple weeks later, and just hit it off.
My name's Bill Helms, and I was Joe DeAngelo's co-worker and friend for 11 years, 3 months. We worked the same shift, 40 hours a week. I don't want to say that Joe was a nice guy, because he wasn't. I think there was two Joes. I think there was Joseph DeAngelo and Joe DeAngelo, and the Joe DeAngelo is the one I knew. When I first met Joe, I wanted to kill him. He was real hard to get along with, and after about 5 years, I finally realized that we have to coexist. We don't have to like each other, but be civil to each other. And then we started liking each other, I mean, I knew what made him mad, so I didn't do it. He knew what made me mad, and he did it still, but anyway. He had his good points. But I guess he had a lot worse points than he did good.
When I first met Joe, I thought he was different. I was like, well, why does this guy want to fish with me? There's a lot of racism in this world, and people view things different, you know, than other folks. And there's a few guys on the job would come out and say, why would you take that black guy with you? But see, what they didn't realize, Joe has a granddaughter that's half black. And I didn't know that until I met her finally. I would wonder that too up until that point.
There was one whole year that I didn't speak to Joe at all, not one word. One time I was changing a windshield on a truck that just came off the road, and it was 105 degrees that day, and I had my own personal fan pointed up at me, and he walked over and twice turned that fan off. He didn't want to hear it roaring, and I had to climb down off the top of the engine where I was standing and turn it back on. And I told him the second time I turned it back on, that if he turned it off again, I was going to break his fucking hand. And I really meant it. Every night he'd have a different issue with a different person. I've heard more four-letter words thrown at Joe than you could ever imagine. We had a boss one time that would humiliate Joe and really treated Joe crappy. We've all talked about it at work, you know, and if he's going to kill anybody, it probably would have been him.
We were fishing at Folsom Lake one time, and there were some ladies on the beach. And he said, what if one of them come over here? Or what if one of them get naked, just run out here? What would you do? How would you react? And I said, you know how I react. I'd jump off your boat. I'd be over there. He said, yeah, I know you'd leave me, huh? He said, yeah. And then there was another time. We were fishing. Some guys came by. A lot of fishermen, when you're fishing in your area, they don't want to be disturbed. Okay. Like some guys came to disturb the water. Joe actually, you know, got close to him and let him know how he felt about that. There were a few times I seen him angry, you know, but that's how Joe was. He was never quiet, never quiet. He'd let you know verbally, very loud, very loud. Yeah, he'd holler sometimes. In fact, there was many times me and him argued about little things, crazy things, you know. I might drop some liver blood on his boat and not wipe it up immediately, and he'd get mad. We start arguing. That was late at night, in the dark, on the water. There was never a time I was scared. Because he would tell me, you know, I have your life in my hands, and I will say the same for you. Because we out here together. But he was captain of the boat. But now that I look back, I think like, ooh, God's been looking after me. Because people at work tell me, you know, he must have really liked you. You know, because all the times I hear about you guys arguing, he never, you know, tried anything with you, you know. So I was truly blessed.
See those white things over there by the top of the boat? The white PVC stuff? Those are off of his boat. The day that he dropped those off here was the day that he went and stopped at a Hobby Lobby when they swabbed the side of his car. They were watching him even when he came here. I've been to his house lots of times. Joe's house was real nice. Everything was perfect. He had Roman tiles, just all brand new. He had bookshelves custom made for the walls so they fit. Redid his kitchen. I mean, there wasn't a blade of grass out of place there. Yeah. He did have model airplanes on the kitchen table. He used to have little drag boats, gas-powered drag boats. But one time I went over there and he goes, hey, you want to see my girlfriends? I go, yeah, I want to see this. So I followed him into the bedroom, and he had two beds in the bedroom, and he had six nice fishing poles laying on one of them. He was, I think he'd given up on women by then. And he was just a fisherman.
Joseph DeAngelo and Sharon Huddle separated in 1991. In an odd twist, Sharon Huddle is a divorce attorney. But at the time of DeAngelo's arrest, they were still married.
She didn't live with him. He said he was married for, you know, tax purposes and so she'd get medical and stuff. But he never really said a whole lot. I know that he put his daughters through medical school. That's why he worked so long. He worked an extra 7 years at Save Mart, past what he had to. He's probably got to be sorry he did that now. But he did, you know. I don't know if it's because they say he murdered a man and woman that were doctors. I wouldn't think that that's why he did this. But maybe he thought he was trying to better the world by putting doctors out there. All three of his daughters are doctors.
When I first met Joe, he didn't reveal much of his past. And, you know, as time went on, he started telling me little things about his life. He told me when he was a little kid that they were very poor. For fun, he would go down to the lake and skip rocks off the water. That was the only fun they had. And His mom would go sometimes without eating just so they can eat. Their clothes weren't the best. He didn't talk much about his dad. He didn't talk about his sisters either, you know, and he has a couple, but he didn't talk much about them at all. And as he was older, he never told me about things that have come out now, such as being a police officer. I never knew about that. I never knew he went to college. I guess, he told me what he wanted everyone to know.
Joe never told me anything about his past. He talked about his mother from time to time, but I don't remember him ever talking about his dad. Well, I was there when he found out his mom died, and he's pretty upset about it. He actually used my phone to call and find out. Now I know why. It was in Ventura. I don't think he wanted any trace that Ventura, you know, to be on any trace of the phone, you know, where he worked. Both because we have a recorded line at work. I thought it was a little strange. One time Joe told me, sometimes I do things that I can't explain.
He would say that, I'm so lucky. He was set up. His house paid off. New boat, new car, new truck, new motorcycle. Just remodeled his house. Had no bills, you know, but everyday expenses for living, no bills. He retired, so he felt blessed. Now, I don't know if he was referring to the things that everybody's accusing him of or he's being accused of. Whether he was blessed not to get caught for those, I don't know. He would say that all the time. I am so lucky, huh, Richard? I'm lucky, huh? Yeah, I'm really lucky.
I found out about Joe's arrest. We heard on the news that they found possibly the East Side Rapist. And that he lived in Citrus Heights on Canyon Oak Drive. And I was pouring a cup of coffee. And I go, my God, Joe lives on Canyon Oak Drive. Figured it might be one of his neighbors. So I go running around where Lynn's watching TV on the news. And I go, oh, my God, that's Joe's house. Those are Joe's cars. And she goes, no way. And then they said, Joseph DeAngelo's just been arrested.
I went to work that day. Clocked in at 11. Everybody in the office was like, Richard, have you heard? I said, no, what are you talking about? And they said, you haven't watched the news. And they said, Joe's been arrested. I said, for what? And they said, go watch the news. So I went to the break room and watched the news. And there his house was. There were a lot of cops in front of his house. His boat was out. Cars were out. And then I seen it was posted under the picture on the screen what was going on. And I was like, no, it can't be. I did my truck inspection, got in the truck, and was going out the gate. And one of the supervisors came up to me and said, you all right, Richard? And then I guess it just hit me hard. I'd start watering, tears, and everything else. But that's how I learned about Joe's arrest at work. And was I affected by it big time?
So right now I'm standing in front of DeAngelo's driveway.
On the day of the arrest, Joseph DeAngelo's quiet neighborhood was bombarded first by law enforcement and then by the media. Months later, there's still occasional media activity. Neighbors peek out their windows, wondering when this attention will end. Today's no different, and Paul spots Natalia and Eric peeking out the window, a few doors down from Joseph DeAngelo's home. And Paul can't help doing what he's done for the past 24 years, gather more information on the Golden State Killer.
Yeah, he was in Detroit on business.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
When the arrest happened.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I was like, I called him up. I'm like, you know, freak? Because that's what we called him. Yeah. Well, they just carried him off. Apparently, he was a serial killer and rapist.
Now, why did you guys call him freak?
Because he used to freak out on the driveway all the time.
What does that mean? What was he doing?
Everybody talking about he'd have his tirades on the driveway. He would just start yelling and cursing and stuff like that.
And is he saying any names?
No, he was just general cursing.
Just at himself?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or he lost his keys. Where are my effing keys, you know?
Joe would lose his keys. You know, he'd be trying to find them. I seen Joe cut off probably 5 or 6 paddle locks off his locker over the years. Yeah, he would talk to himself sometimes at night. Oh, my God, what did I do in my last life to deserve this? Well, now we know.
He would get angry about small things. Can't find your keys. He'd go off.
And he's yelling at the top of his lungs.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd see him out in front.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He would, in fact, when he would freak out like that, we would and go back into our home, you could still hear him from inside the house.
Yeah. So, but you're seeing him actually out and about during the day.
Oh, yeah. He would take meticulous care of his lawn. He mowed it. He liked it nice and short. And then he would get down on his hands and knees and hand clip around all those decorative rocks.
Oh, wow. Now, when you first moved in, do you remember what kind of cars he was driving?
He had a really old...
Sentra?
Yeah, Toyota. He's always a Toyota guy.
His Toyota, what car was it? Or what color was it?
White.
It was white, yeah.
It was white. And when you say really old, like what? How old?
Well, I mean, it's like an older style...
Like the 80s.
Sentra.
80s.
You know, like, yeah.
He did have a bicycle that he used to ride, and he had the spandex he would put on and ride his bicycle. And then he also had a motorcycle that he used to ride.
Okay.
A motorcycle. And
now the bicycle, was that a 10-speed style racing?
Yes.
Road bike? Okay.
No.
Not like a mountain bike style?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, just your, typical,
And how long ago was that that he was putting on the spandex and doing that?
Like a few years. Recently.
Relatively
recently.
The arrest, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when we saw him on the news in the wheelchair, we were laughing because I was like, oh, please.
Right.
Oh, please.
I agree with you.
So the neighbors behind them, and Paul, you probably know more about it than we do, is that they have had a dog. I don't know if they still have it, and it would bark. And Joe hates dogs. Yeah. And so the dog would be barking during the day, and of course he's home during the day. So he actually went around to their backyard. He went around the block and went into the backyard and threatened the mom. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but threatened her. And so that scared the, poop out of him.
But he also left a voice message on their machine too. And I think according to the story that they tell, is that they recognized it was Joe's voice.
Yeah.
You know, I think when you see something like this on the news, it's always like, they're always saying, oh, we never would have suspected him, right? And I think a lot of people here, were thinking, of all the people in the neighborhood, for this to be the guy, pieces started falling into place, because how he behaved and stuff like that, right?
And that's interesting. I know I've... over the course of my investigation, I had many suspects I was looking into. And, of course, talking to, co-workers and friends, oh, it couldn't be him, And
right.
I could never rely upon that because of what you're just saying. Yeah. Because how often do you see in the news, I never would have suspected it was him.
Right.
But it's interesting that now we've identified him.
Yes.
The personality aspects are coming out where you guys are going, we can kind of see it.
Yeah, and I can totally see the anger.
We feel sorry for the daughters and the granddaughters.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Of course the victims, but also the family.
Yeah.
And find out that your father and grandfather...
And in many ways, they're his last victims.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very true.
It is so unfortunate that they're having to live through that.
For decades, investigators in 11 California counties, FBI agents, and online sleuths around the world have worked tirelessly to identify the Golden State Killer. Armed with evidence of what he did, they hunted for his name. Who is he? Now, although we may have that answer, there's still one gaping hole in the case. Why did he do it? And he may never tell us. But his victims have something to tell him.
The message that I hope that he gets from me, no matter how that happens, maybe it's from this recording right here. Somehow I want him to get a message from me that says, you did not get away with this. I want him to know that he thought all of his evil deeds were going to be secret forever, that nobody would ever know. And he was wrong. We know it all now. We don't have to know the details, but we know it all.